I'm Sam Cedar.
And I'm Emma Vigeland. This week on Ring of Fire, Ted Miller, professor at Northeastern University and author of the upcoming book, A Conspiratorial Life, Robert Welch, the John Birch Society, and the Revolution of American Conservatism, joins me to discuss his piece in The New Republic, The John Birch Society Never Left.
And Heather Digby Parton will help me run down the biggest news stories of the week. Hey, become a member of this podcast over at rofpodcast.com. It is your support that helps keep this show going. And don't forget, you can watch the interviews from the Ring of Fire podcast on the Majority Report YouTube channel. Head over to youtube.com/Sam Cedar, S-A-M-S-E-D-E-R. Here to break down this week's news, Heather Digby Parton from Salon and, of course, her very popular blog, Hullabaloo. So this week, we had people began to feel the impact of the $1.9 trillion COVID relief bill. We had some Republican states that were pretty upset to find, I guess what you call an Easter egg or a non-Easter egg in it that would not allow them to use this funding for states and municipalities to provide tax cuts. And from maybe not just a progressive wish list. Anybody who really is concerned about the anti-democratic nature of the Senate, Joe Biden signaled that he was open to serious filibuster reform. Here to talk to me about all of that and more from this past week, Heather Parton, writer for Salon, also the proprietor of one of my favorite blogs, one of the Uber blogs, as I call them, Hullabaloo. Heather, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Sam.
So, Heather, let's start with that big news. I mean, we have a lot of legislation that people have been talking about, things like H.R. 1, things like the $15 minimum wage, et cetera, et cetera. And none of that, all of that, or much of that, I should say, was a dead on arrival, because the only way that Democrats could pass anything, we thought, was reconciliation. There are going to be two more opportunities for reconciliation bills. But again, $15 minimum wage ruled by the parliamentarian not to be applicable because of the Byrd rule. Of course, H.R. 1 doesn't deal at all with the budget, so not applicable according to the Byrd rule. And we're stuck with this filibuster. But Joe Biden this week sort of changed the calculus, didn't he?
He sure did. And he was one of the people, you know, in the whole political establishment who had been very clear. And in fact, he had his press secretary, Jen Psaki, out there saying that he didn't want to change the filibuster. He didn't think it should be changed. The filibuster's fine. Old school, you know, Senate Democrat. And we all had the impression that he was going to, now, you know, we didn't know if there was a strategy there. It's entirely possible that he was just, you know, taking that side in order to, you know, leave room for Joe Manchin to do something or what, you know, you never know with that stuff. But he had been pretty clear about this for months and months that he was not going, if there was going to be a filibuster fight, Joe Biden was not going to weigh in on it. And he wasn't, at the very least, going to be someone who would endorse changes to the filibuster. Well, the other day he did an interview on ABC News with George Stephanopoulos, and Stephanopoulos asked him about it, and he said, yeah, he just said, yes. Are you open to a reform of the filibuster? Yes, I am. And he was talking specifically about the talking filibuster, which is sort of that's kind of an umbrella term for a number of potential rules changes that would require people to be present for the filibuster. It would require them to reach certain numerical goals in order to sustain a filibuster, and that people have to talk and they've got to make their case on the floor about why they're objecting. And this is the thing that has been missing from this filibuster. All they ever had to do was go count noses and then say, well, we're going to filibuster this. And everybody, well, okay, never mind. And there was no pain involved in doing it. There was no requirement that anybody had to make a case, even to the public, about why they were filibustering. They just, you know, Mitch McConnell in particular would just say, well, we're filibustering. you know, and that's it. And so there was nothing. So these were sort of, they were called a silent filibuster, or I guess people are calling it a virtual filibuster.
Right.
Well, that seems to be the most likely way that they can get someone like Joe Manchin or Kyrsten Sinema or others who are pretending that, you know, the filibuster is some kind of a sacred, you know, sacred rule in the Senate, which of course it is not. It's actually fairly recent and was used mostly to deny civil rights to Black people, a relic of Jim Crow, as Barack Obama said it. But nonetheless, you know, it, we have seen it being whittled away over the last few years for a number of things on both the Republican and Democrat side. They no longer can filibuster for cabinet nominees. They can't filibuster for judicial nominees. They can't filibuster for
Supreme Court justices.
Supreme Court. And they can't filibuster for these budgetary rules that can go through reconciliation, as the COVID relief bill did, as the big McConnell Trump tax cuts did. Paul Ryan, got to add his name in there too. And so, you know, there have been many exceptions built into the filibuster. So this is not really a new thing. But what has happened in this extreme polarization of our, you know, system at the moment, and the fact that the Republicans have basically decided that they are no longer in the business of legislating. They are in the business of obstruction of all things that Democrats want to do, and confirming judges and passing tax cuts if they're in the majority. That's it. That's all they do. So this has become, it's an impasse that is truly making it impossible for the government to function. And I think that people are starting to get, you know, they're starting to recognize that if they don't do something here, that this thing is really going to fall apart. I mean, they can't keep doing it, even Joe Biden. So him coming out this week and saying that openly and kind of echoing what Joe Manchin had said earlier, although he's been dancing around it since then, and we don't really know what he means, but it's obvious that it's on the table. That the filibuster reform in one way or another, something that's going to make it different and make it theoretically possible for Democrats to pass legislation with 50 votes. And by the way, I think you and I both know this, that's not easy.
Right.
You still got Joe Manchin and you still got Kyrsten and you still got.
I was going to mention that I don't think that guarantees us $15 minimum wage. I think that ends up getting us maybe a $13 minimum wage or something like that. But we can talk about that in a moment. But yeah, I think, and here's the thing that I think people should understand, which I think is so big, because they could have done a situation where they said, we're going to create a reconciliation type framework for, let's say, H.R. 1, which is their big voting rights bill, anti-corruption bill. And they could have said, we have a special exemption from the filibuster for budgetary things. We're also going to have a special exemption for democracy things or voting things. Right. And they could have done that. And that was being floated at one point. But they must have made a calculation in the White House. And you know, who knows who's involved in these conversations, that, you know what? We're going to take a hit. We're going to take a hit if we do anything. So we might as well just go for it. Like, you know, this is the thing I think they learned from the Obama years, which is like, you know, you could have done $1.2 trillion for that, for the financial crisis bailout, but you wanted to keep it under a trillion. Everybody was afraid of that. Well, the fact is that the Republicans just went out and said, you just spent $1 trillion anyways. And so if you're going to get criticized for it, you might as well get the upside for it. And people should understand that as the filibuster exists now, it is binary. It is like you either will get the vote or you won't get the vote on this. And because there are 50, you need 60 senators, and it's binary. It's not even the procedure. It's, when they start talking about how easy it is to do the filibuster now, what it's code for, when they say we're going to make it harder, what they're actually saying is we're going to take away the binary aspect of the filibuster, which is the filibuster at the end of the day can be overcome. As it stands now, the filibuster cannot be overcome. Right. They've made it super convenient, but they made it super convenient because everybody knows, like, you can't overcome this. because you need 60 votes. You don't have 60 votes. If you change it, like where the people waging the filibuster need 40 votes, then you've put the burden on them. So they have to get the votes and get people there at the time. And that's not always easy to do, particularly if you don't control the schedule, because Chuck Schumer could easily say, like, call him back into Senate, into session. Oh, what's that? Oh, I'm sorry to hear that 10 of your senators have flown out to Texas, you know, exactly. to the West Coast, or, you know, wherever, Texas and to Montana and Wyoming. And I'm sorry, are they down south now too? Oh, you've only got 35 people who are in Washington. Well, I don't know what to tell you. You don't have your 40 votes. Cloture is a motion to proceed, and we can then vote. I mean, the idea being that whatever mechanism they're going to create, whether it's the talking filibuster or they're going to change the burden of votes, they are not going to create, they're not going to, well, in my opinion, and it would be almost incomprehensible that they would allow for a system that they couldn't ultimately overcome when they wanted to.
Yeah.
In other words, that like you can dress it up and say, well, they could hold the floor, but they're not going to allow like passing it off to other people. They're not going to give the Republicans, if they do this, they're not going to give the Republicans a loophole in which they could actually theoretically, you know, keep a bill from getting voted on. And that's a big deal. And Joe Biden, there, I mean, not only like there's nobody who can trump him as a Senate institutionalist. Mm-hmm. He's literally been there almost, and I think older than people think, for almost my entire life. I think he was six when he got into the Senate, like he in 1972, like there's nobody who can say, you know, I'm a Senate institutionalist, Joe, and I just can't do this. He's just going to go like, you're not a bigger institutionalist than me. And he actually, in that interview, which I thought was really interesting, he flipped it. He said that we have broken tradition with the filibuster. It used to be, you know, this never happened. And, you know, he wasn't incredibly eloquent or articulate about it, but that's the point. And so what I think we're going to get is a vote on a bunch of these things. And I think, like, you know, what's also fascinating is that there's 20 senators meeting, ongoing meetings over the course of this past week that, on one hand, you know, like, I just don't buy it. I think they did this before the $1.9 trillion bill too, didn't they? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. They did that. And of course, out of the, you know, the 20 senators they're talking about, it's 10 Democrats and 10 Republicans. Five of those, I mean, the 10 Democrats are, we know what the span, you know, the scope of their ideology is, right? It goes from Joe Manchin probably to, I don't know, Elizabeth Warren, say. So we know what that is. And there are issues within that for sure. But on the Republican side, you have maybe three or four, maybe five, who might be willing to do some negotiating. That's it. This other 10, I don't know who they are, but there's no way they're going to get 10. I guess that's my point. And that's part of what happened with the $1.9 trillion. Because, you know, Joe invited them up. They had some coffee. They chit-chatted. They, you know, chewed the fat, reminisced, did whatever they did. But there was no way, and he knew it too, that they were going to get the 10 votes. I mean, the reason that he picked 10 Republicans, of course, is the 60. They're trying to preserve the filibuster and pretend like, oh, hey, you know, not a problem. We'll let you, we'll negotiate and we won't have to filibuster. It'll be fine. And that's just not realistic and it's not going to happen. And I don't get the sense that the Democrats really believe that's going to happen. There seems to have been, I mean, you got, you know, sort of moderate types like John Tester and people like that who are going, no, you know, we've been down this road before and we're not going to do that again. But what this does do, regardless, is if they, and they have to actually do it, they have to get rid of, they have to reform the filibuster. Once they do that, that actually does open up the door to bipartisan negotiations.
Yep.
It's not going to be 10. But there may be a case where you can get a Mitt Romney or a, you know, or a Murkowski or one of those people to actually do some bipartisan work on issues that they care about, or maybe somebody out of the blue, you know, somebody who wants an infrastructure project in their state or whatever. by getting rid of the filibuster, you end this, as you put it, and I think it's a good way of thinking about it, this binary thing. It is or it isn't. It's all or nothing. There's no in between. There's none of that. So all these people who want bipartisan negotiations, and, you know, I don't have anything against it as a, you know, a conceptual thing. I mean, bargaining with Republicans at this point in their evolution seems a little bit, you know, unlikely to me, but you never know. But the point is that if this is what they're looking for, if people want their, you know, they don't want to lose their ability to have a, you know, as Manchin puts it, the minority has to have a voice. Well, hey, you want a voice, then maybe you ought to negotiate in good faith instead of this obstructive, you know, just total obstruction, which is, this is Mitch McConnell's strategy. And he's the one who created this situation. I mean, Biden was right, as he inarticulately put it. This change is recent, and the filibuster, this is not the way we traditionally did filibusters. That's because Mitch McConnell decided that obstruction, 100% obstruction, was the best, you know, was the strategy for Republicans. And he felt that that was the way it was going to go. And they filibustered everything.
And it worked. It worked. All right, listen, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk about Mitch McConnell. You wrote about him this past week, last week. And I want to talk about that. And I also want to talk about the other change that we haven't touched on yet, that speaks directly to that point you were making about the idea that you may have some bipartisan agreements. I'll just say it. We haven't said it in 10 years, at least. Earmarks. We'll be right back after this break. So the COVID relief bill has passed. We now are living in an era where we have the president of the United States, the guy with the most seniority, or pretty darn close. It's still in our government, who served in the Senate, has the probably claim to be a Senate institutionalist, coming out in support of the filibuster. And Heather Parton and I have been talking about the implications of this. You wrote a piece in Salon recently about Mitch McConnell. Mitch McConnell came out after Joe Biden had that interview, I think it was, with Stephanopoulos, saying that he was open to some type of filibuster reform. And Mitch McConnell just came out and said, like, if you get rid of the filibuster, you're not going to believe what we're going to do. And everybody was like, we totally believe what you're going to do, because you've been doing it constantly. And so, I mean, this is a guy who's sitting there with an empty quiver going like, don't make me shoot you with this bow and arrow. Well, it's already happened. But this is what's going to be interesting, because we're going to get something like H.R. 1. If the filibuster is moved, we're going to get that bill is going to pass. And I don't think there's not a lot of latitude for some type of agreement. Like, I don't know what, you know, Lisa Murkowski wants to come in with H.R. 1 or Mitt Romney going to come in on H.R. 1. There may be a little nibbling around some of the disclosure for corporate money and stuff like that, because I would imagine Joe Manchin wants to sort of like get some wiggle room there. And I imagine a bunch of these senators do, frankly. And if they can say, well, we need it to be bipartisan, and so we decided to, you know, I listened to my colleagues, and this is the way the bill has turned out, there could be a little bit of that. But where we're going to really see this is, it seems to me, is in the context of things like the minimum wage. Like, we will get a vote on the $15 minimum wage. But what's going to happen, it seems to me, is that Joe Manchin is going to team up maybe four or five other people in the maybe some of those eight that voted against it, Bernie Sanders' amendment. And they're going to go and hook up with four or five Republicans. And they're going to drive the minimum wage down. They're going to drive it down to 11 or 12 bucks or 13 bucks. It's outrageous. But this is the problem is that we have too many Republicans in the Senate and too many corporate Democrats who will use the Republicans as cover. But earmarks, that's going to change things a little bit. Will you just remind people what earmarks are? Because we haven't talked about them in 10 years.
Well, I know. And it used to be that earmarks, what they call earmarks, were really, I mean, this was horse trading. It's, you know, good old fashioned horse trading that we assumed was part of politics forever. I mean, it was your state, you need a, you know, you want a new bridge, you know, over here, and this guy, he needs a, you know, a new hospital or whatever, you know, then whatever they need, roads and what have you. They would negotiate these things. And in fact, I mean, we went through this with Obamacare. Do you remember, you know, the Cornhusker kickback, they called it, because they gave something special to Ben Nelson from Nebraska that was, you know, they had that. Well, it used to be that this was a normal thing. And a lot of us, you know, a lot of the good government people, we were all, you know, up in arms about, you know, this kind of thing. It was corrupt and it was spending, you know, it was the fleecing of America. You remember they used to do those specials on TV about how they were spending all this money on these boondoggles. But as it turns out, that it makes it very, very difficult to do government without at least some of this ability to do this. And it ended up being, and I don't, you know, my recollection, maybe you can correct me. I mean, this was a Republican thing, getting rid of earmarks, was it not? I mean, wasn't this?
I don't think it was. Was it us? I think it was the Democrats did it as well. I think that it was 2011, and I think there was sort of a bipartisan push. It was part of the austerity, and this is after Obama had made the austerity pivot, and there was all this notion of like, I mean, this the getting rid of earmarks seems to me was maybe the penultimate moment of like an anti-government sentiment, right? It was the idea that this government spending was wasteful and the government and it was like lard and this and that. And, you know, to be clear, like it is not necessarily the most efficient way to make sure that you're distributing resources across the country, you know, like congressman or the senator, she's getting she's getting money for a museum because her donors are, you know, whatever it is.
Well, remember the Bridge to Nowhere? I mean, that was kind of the big thing that sort of, and I just have a little bit of, you know, personal kind of experience with this because I used to live in Alaska. Alaska is entirely dependent on the federal government, really. That has no state income tax. It has a lot of military up there. It has oil revenue. Is there one way of, you know, sort of financing things and federal government largesse? So Ted Stevens, who was very, very, very powerful Republican in the Senate for many, many years, he made a fetish of getting, you know, huge, you know, numbers of these projects up there. And the Bridge to Nowhere was an Alaskan project. It was literally a bridge that went to someplace where there were no humans. It was like a bridge to, you know, moose. And it was, you know, ridiculous. But on the other hand, when you think about it, and I always felt that this was part of that story that never got enough, you know, sort of amplification, was the fact Alaska is a United State, you know, it's one of the states, and it is very, very conservative now. It used to be a little bit less conservative. It was very conservative now, anti-government, you know, I mean, Sarah Palin is from Alaska. But yet they were entirely dependent on all this government financing, just, you know, for the people who live there. I mean, there was that. It created jobs to build the Bridge to Nowhere, you know, people work and what have you. So, I mean, this was kind of the conundrum there, which is that you had this Republican, you know, this anti-government Republican party that was nonetheless, you know, and we still seeing it today, you know, they are dependent on federal, you know, programs and federal projects in order to, you know, support their people. So, you know, the earmark situation, which I think everybody had in mind, you know, it was corrupt in a million ways. And if they do reintroduce them, they probably need, you know, some different guidelines. But nonetheless, you know, the fact is that this was a way of making government function. And it perhaps, you know, we should all be better than that, but it just is a fact. And I think that the fact that the Democrats came in and are putting earmarks back on the table, I think it's what it is. It signals that, look, we got to get some stuff done. We have to do that. We've got to get things done.
There's a broader perspective here that I think this is indicative of, and why I think it marks such a, and there's been a lot of talk, and we've had these conversations about the end of the Reaganism era. And look, this is the case with every government program. I mean, it's the case with everything. Anybody who's worked in any type of like corporate setting or any major company, just, you know, look around, you know, there's a tremendous amount of waste, right? I mean, you have executives who hire and create all sorts of sort of like waste, extra positions below them, so that when the inevitable downturn happens and they need to juice profits, they cut people. And this is an unspoken strategy in middle upper management. Mm-hmm. You got to get as many people underneath you as possible, even if you've got to create jobs for them, so that you have someone to cut mm-hmm. when the time comes, because it's all relative. You know, this is all part of it. But the fact is that there is no government program that isn't wasteful. I mean, Janet Yellen said something like this the other day, actually, a couple of weeks ago, maybe, about in regards to targeting relief for people. COVID. Mm-hmm. She said, you know, you can target the relief, but invariably when you target, you miss hidden pockets of pain. Mm-hmm. And so the bottom line being that, like, if you want government to function, if you want it to serve the most amount of people possible, people, make sure that you serve all the people who really need government, which is, frankly, the overwhelming majority of Absolutely. Us. And then, of course, the people who don't need government now, the reason why they're in a position to not need government is because they had government before, right? Wow. Like, you know, Jeff Bezos, he doesn't need government. He could be his own government, but none of this would have existed. None of his billions would have existed without the U.S. government. But the point is, you're going to have some modicum of waste. And this and the notion of earmarks, which can be, you know, good earmarks. There can be good earmarks, too. There can be, you know, I'm building a community. You know, we need money for a community hospital in my district or in my state. You're going to have some measure of waste to make the government function better and to actually deliver for the rest of the people. Mm-hmm. And it's like there's. For whatever reason it is, we look upon government waste as somehow fundamentally more problematic than the waste that we see every day, the waste that we have in our homes. You know, who can say that, like, you know, after we're done with our dinner, every single piece of food has been eaten. We don't throw anything away. I mean, nobody, everybody has a certain amount of waste. And it is, you know, we can try and minimize it. And I think that's, but to fetishize the right. minimization of waste in the context of government is what ends up leading to more and more pain. And, you know, that is why, you know, something like earmarks, there's going to be boondoggles, like you say, mm-hmm. and white elephants, but it's also going to make sure that people get the help and the support from government that they need. The other thing that we should talk about in regards to the filibuster, and it's a little bit early, it's going to be the PRO Act, because mm-hmm. that's a situation where you have a piece of legislation that is going to support unions. It's going to make it much easier to unionize. It's going to protect labor. And there, maybe you get one or two Republicans, but this is also one of those binary things. Like, do you want the PRO Act? Do you want this to help unions or not? Right? There's no $11 $12, you know, I put this in quotes, solution to mm-hmm. the PRO Act. And that's going to be another bill that is going to be that could really signify a change in the Democratic governance. All right. Lastly,
there's an interesting thing, just to add one little bit please. Here, that you're finding some of these Republicans now suddenly, you know, they're putting on a show, of course, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, talking pro-union all of a sudden. You know, they're coming out and making these comments on Twitter and whatever. This is going to put them, because they're seeing that they have a more blue-collar constituency and they need to, you know, kind of, they want to keep Ohio and the Senate, et cetera, et cetera. They've got their reasons for that. So it'd be very interesting to see what they do, because this will, you know, put your money where your mouth is, guys. If you care about unions, this is your vote. If you care about those blue collar workers, those, you know, the guys with the steel toe boots that you think are your new people, this is a vote about that. So it'll be very interesting to see how that goes down, because I, you know, I'll be shocked if they do it. But, you know, we'll see.
Well, I mean, but that's a great point, because, you know, there could be one or two of these guys who are like, well, it's sort of a free vote for me because they're going to pass it anyways. But then it becomes the Democrats. This is a bipartisan bill. We had one Republican who joined us, or two Republicans. That's going to be an interesting dynamic. The other interesting dynamic that hasn't gotten much attention is Mitch McConnell going to the Kentucky state legislature and getting them to change the rule how a senator who retires during his term or her term, but in Kentucky, they're both male, his term is replaced. It's been the governor chooses, but the governor is a Democrat. And I don't know if McConnell secured this, but he's been working, supposedly trying to figure out how to get it so that the Kentucky state legislature does it. They're Republicans. Maybe Mitch has basically said, like, checkmate. If they do this filibuster thing, I got nothing left. I'm done. And I mean,
wouldn't surprise me.
Well, I mean, that could be a very interesting dynamic too, because I don't know if there's somebody, I mean, Mitch McConnell, people like to sort of denigrate him because I think he's not a very good human being, but as a leader in the Senate, his time in that Senate between the obstruction during the Obama years and the ramming through all those judges who are going to outlive probably all of us. Mm-hmm. He has made his mark on this country in a way that I don't know that a senator has in decades, frankly.
Definitely. And I mean, it is a negative mark.
Indeed.
There's no doubt about it. You know, they call him, you know, he likes to refer to himself as the Grim Reaper, and, you know, someone else, I can't remember who it was, he referred to him as the grave digger of democracy, with the way that he handled what everything that we were just talking about with the obstruction and the manipulation of the Senate rules in order to get what he wanted. This guy has been very effective at doing that. He doesn't have any real big legislation to his name other than some tax cuts. I mean, he's not really, that's not what he's been about. But he will have left a very, very big legacy. And, you know, there was some question back a few months ago whether maybe he had some kind of an illness. Do you remember they saw some pictures of him with some odd, you know, bruises on his hand and stuff? So maybe, you know, look, the guy is he's elderly. I mean, I think he's 79. I mean, same age as Joe Biden. But, you know, perhaps he is seeing that if the filibuster goes away, I mean, I think you're right, that if for some reason he loses the ability to carry out his strategy and we suddenly start to see a whole bunch of people freelancing, which is what will happen if there's even a tiny bit of, that's where the power lies, right? I mean, if in a 50-50 Senate, everybody has the ability to make or break mm-hmm. legislation, Republican or Democrat. He loses a lot of power if that happens. And maybe he has just thought, you know, hey, maybe it's time for me to move on, because his strategy is no longer operative. If they take it, the filibuster is his major tool. So, you know, we'll see. And he was upset. I mean, I don't know if people saw that. If you didn't see his speech on the floor, I mean, it was a tantrum. I mean,
yes,
threats. I mean, I couldn't believe it. It was like, wow, you know.
Yep. He was very angry.
And the second in command of the Democrats, I thought it was very, he came out afterwards. He goes, yeah, he's probably going to do everything he said. Yeah. Well, yeah, he already has.
Right,
I mean,
exactly.
He really did just shrug it off. I mean, it was kind of amazing.
It's fascinating. And I, you know, I may be mistaken, but I don't think that we're going to see his replacement. I don't know who it would be.
I don't know who.
You know, it's a very weird time with the Republican Party. And yeah. I don't, Mitch McConnell has been ruling with an iron fist in that caucus. And you know what happens when there's a loosening of a grip of an iron fisted dictator? That is usually when those type of rebellions happen. Well, Heather, we didn't even touch on this one last thing. Maybe we should just do it in 1 minute. Within the COVID bill, I mean, you and I know talked about this. At one point, there were some moderate Democratic senators who met with Joe Biden who were concerned about the state and city financing. And it was reported in a weird way. I remember the angle on the report was like they're coming in to cut it. But if you read into the reporting, they were concerned, supposedly, about the idea that there were Republican governors who were going to use this funding meant for states and cities to finance tax cuts in their state. And if they're Republicans, you can guess where that tax cuts are, you know, they're going to. But nevertheless, like, you know, there's cutting taxes for wealthy people in this situation is just simply an inefficient way to stimulate the economy. And particularly when there's all this desperate need for infrastructure. And instead of cutting that money, you know, it's one of those things like you got to pass the bill to find out what's in it. They had a provision that basically said for every tax dollar that you cut from your tax rolls after receiving this money, we claw back. You cannot finance those. You cannot fill gaps that are created by cutting taxes with this money. This money must be expended at the baseline of your taxes now. And Ohio has filed suit. We expect some other Republican. It's going to be an interesting case. Like, you know, I don't know why the federal government couldn't stipulate that, like, this money is, you get it if, you know, based upon these conditions, if you don't want the money, don't take the money. You want to cut taxes, you cut taxes. This is really, I thought that provision was really, really encouraging. Really,
very,
encouraging.
Very interesting. Very interesting. And it is going to go to court. They've already filed, and it's probably going to be joined by a bunch of other, I don't know, attorneys general, I guess, in the various states. So we'll see how the courts deal with it. But it is, you know, it is about time, I would just say. The Democrats looked at this stuff, you know, with that kind of anticipation of yep. how they know they have to know how this is going to, you know, they were kind of cut short on the Obamacare thing, right? Because the Medicaid expansion was the biggest part of it. It was the one thing that was so, so important that Democrats couldn't vote against the bill, no matter what was in it. That Medicaid expansion was huge, but they didn't do that. You know, they mm-hmm. didn't make it so that the states had to take the money.
Well, that was the Supreme Court. I mean, nobody anticipated. I mean, I interviewed a bunch of like lawyers out actually in front of the Supreme Court. We'd set up something for that case. And I say I interviewed probably a dozen over the course of 2 or 3 days. And they all, like almost to a person, laughed off the idea that the federal government couldn't dictate.
They possibly do that.
You couldn't expand Medicaid. Mm-hmm. Well, Heather, we'll have more to talk about next week. Always a pleasure. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me, Sam. It was fun.
Heather Parton is a weekly contributor to Ring of Fire Radio. You can find her writings over at Salon.com and the popular blog Hullabaloo. Now I'm going to hand the show over to our new Ring of Fire co-host, Emma Vigeland.
Thanks, Sam. Hi, everyone. Here with me right now is Ted Miller, professor at Northeastern University, author of the upcoming book, A Conspiratorial Life, Robert Welch, the John Birch Society, and the Revolution of American Conservatism. And he's joined me to discuss his piece in The New Republic, The John Birch Society Never Left. Thanks so much for joining me today, Ted.
Oh, it's a great pleasure to be here.
Piece was fascinating. We were talking a little bit before the show, just how cyclical all of these right-wing narratives are and how much you can learn from history, really, when studying anything, but in this case, the modern Republican Party and the modern conservative movement. So just let's start broadly. Can you explain a brief history of the John Birch Society for people who may not know, and Robert Welch and his role in it? Because I'll just briefly say, it seems to kind of be the few decades past equivalent of some of the conspiracy peddling that we're seeing with QAnon in today's right wing.
Yes, absolutely. The John Birch Society was a far right organization that was begun by a candy maker, the candy maker who created such childhood favorites as the Sugar Daddy and the Junior Mints in the late 1950s.
I love Junior Mints. That's so unfortunate.
Junior Mints are wonderful in the movies, and I don't know if you're going to have them ever again in the movies after that.
Yeah, I may not.
But the John Birch Society was a far-right organization that there was a sort of a myth behind it that it was purged from the conservative movement by William F. Buckley because of the conspiracy theories associated with the John Birch Society. Robert Welch said that Dwight Eisenhower was a communist. And Robert Welch said that the civil rights movement was run by the communists. And Robert Welch said that it was a conspiracy to put fluoride in drinking water, and that could lead you to communism. There were many, many other conspiracy theories that Robert Welch got involved in. And there was a myth that Buckley purged him from the society. And I don't think that's the case. In my new book, I'm going to say that it continued well into the 1970s. In fact, the 1970s was the high point of the John Birch Society, when it serves as a beacon for the moral majority in the coming Reagan revolution.
So, yeah, I want to go into Ronald Reagan for sure. But first, we have to start with William F. Buckley, who people may remember. He was involved in those infamous / famous Gore Vidal debates that were televised, I believe, on ABC. Was kind of seen as a more mainstream version of conservatism, and he had a very colorful personality. Wow. A lot of conservatives cite him, and, you know, infamously Donald Trump, I keep saying that word, but it was in the 2016 presidential debates, when Ted Cruz was going after New York values, Donald Trump very artfully cited William F. Buckley as being from New York. Yes, it was a very good line by him, by the way, and it's just why he was effective in those Republican primaries, which is shown through there, in my view. But William F. Buckley was seen as a hero by a lot of conservatives. Can you talk about his role as related to the John Birch Society and why?
Sure.
He gave them a voice and a face to divorce the conspiracy peddling from the conservative movement at the time.
Bill Buckley was a great storyteller. He was probably one of the most prolific writers of the 20th century. And he created a myth. He liked myth. He was like Beowulf killing the dragon Grendel. Grendel being the JBS, the John Birch Society, purging it from the conservative movement. He was a powerful debater, a masterful debater, powerful writer. And he was a historical gatekeeper, and he provided limited access to his papers when he was alive. So he systematically underplayed this continued influence of the Birchers. But he was also a politician, and politicians tell stories. They create myths. He in fact, dreamed of elective office. He once ran for mayor of New York. He loved to hold court to reactionaries and liberals on his sailboat, or in the warm mountain cabins of Aspen or Switzerland. He charmed liberals like John Kenneth Galbraith and Norman Mailer. He would hobnob with Vice President Humphrey. He could be all things to all people. And so he honed the arts of a politician with great subtlety and sophistication. But at the same time, he's carrying out this project of giving the conservative mainstream respectability while moving the center of American politics as far to the right as practically possible. But there never really was a purge of the John Birch Society. In fact, you could argue that William F. Buckley even though he established his credibility as a member of the responsible right, made statements on race and Africa that were even far more incendiary and racist than anything Robert Welch had ever said.
Well, you cite that in your piece, right? So that Buckley once called Africans semi-savages who could not govern themselves, who only if they stopped eating each other. That was one of the quotes that you cited that I wrote down.
There's worse. Yeah. I mean, he says that, I don't know if it's worse. I mean, but it's he says that the 14th and 15th Amendments are inorganic accretions tacked on to the Constitution by the victors at war by force. I mean, those are important amendments, the right to vote for African Americans, the 14th and 15th Amendments. You can go on and on. He said that in his essay, Why the South Must Prevail, that the white community is so entitled to take measures to prevail politically, because for the time being, it is the advanced race. So this is the stuff he was saying.
Well, explicit white supremacy. And so that's my real question to you, is you highlighted very well how Buckley was a gifted orator and he had a quick wit and he was kind of a trash talker. So in that way, Trump does echo a lot of what William F. Buckley presented in terms of a media presence. And then behind the scenes, he was able to make conservatism more palatable for more respectable intellectual types. But there is, a outside of the history of Buckley, in my view, a constant compulsion on a part of the elites and media to normalize conservatism despite these conspiratorial elements that Buckley himself, as you outlined, was as extreme as the less reputable John Birch Society. So can you talk about why that dynamic exists in your view?
Why there's this compulsion among, say, Beltway conservatives to emphasize this more moderate aspects of conservatism to the and avoiding the race, you mean? Yeah.
Well, I was actually even saying Beltway media, there is a desire even of mainstream folks to normalize conservatism, even when these elements were always in existence.
Well, I think one problem is Reagan. One problem is Reagan. Reagan is a master raconteur, right? He's charming. He possessed a knack for expressing dark plots and some very nasty things behind a warm smile and a humble Midwestern demeanor. I mean, he was my president growing up. I grew up in the 1980s. I remember his demeanor. But I think that the Beltway intellectuals failed to hear the dog whistles. That's another thing that's going on. There's a lot of cognitive dissonance when it comes to Ronald Reagan. Reagan was such a transformational figure, that I think people hear what they want to hear and see what they want to see when it comes to Reagan. William Safire, George Will, Cal Thomas, right? The Beltway media, they are going to focus instead of on the racist stuff. They're going to focus on the conservative intellectual triumvirate of libertarianism under Hayek, von Mises, the traditionalists like Russell Kirk, the anti-communists like Whitaker Chambers. And there is a significant intellectual tradition. But they failed to hear Reagan's dog whistles because of cognitive dissonance and because of another thing I think that was going on at the time. And that's the colorblind conservatism. That helps them look the other way, too.
Well, I'm reminded of the same dynamic now. The whole intellectual dark web, I'm not sure if you're familiar with this dynamic, but the whitewashing of a extremism of a Ben Shapiro, for example.
Yeah.
Or just like other, you know, Ben Shapiro could be, you could draw a comparison to Buckley in some situations. But I want to expand on that Reagan point, because you outline in your piece, and I'm sure in your forthcoming book, all of these ways that Reagan was totally off his rocker in terms of right-wing conspiracy theories that he seems to have plucked from the John Birch Society, The explicit racism. He called members of the African United Nations monkeys. He had the conspiracy theories that former President Gerald Ford staged assassination attempts. He said that the Soviet Union got rid of 20 million young people in order to launch nuclear war. This is some of the things that you outline. These are outrageous, nonsensical claims. You wrote, took a conspiracy theory right out of the John Birch Society about Lenin. Can you talk about why that's never a part of the conversation? Is it just Reagan's charm, or is it kind of that same impulse that we were discussing before?
Well, I think that it has a lot to do with that sense of they make a decision about Reagan and they go with it. But he is a phenomenal politician. I mean, I think it has to do with Reagan, that it's his ability to charm. People who walk into the Oval Office speak of not liking him when, you know, you first entered the room. But then when they leave the Oval Office, they are enamored with the man. But he had that incredible ability to charm, but some real nastiness behind the scenes. It's not only... If you'd like me to go into a little bit more detail about some of the other things that he does, he begins his campaign in the same area of the South where three civil rights volunteers, James Chaney, Andrew Goodman, and Michael Schwerner, of course, were killed 16 years earlier. During Freedom Summer. And, you know, why did he begin at this particular point? Well, he launched his presidential campaign in this county because he knew that's where you could get the Wallace voters. And when he got there, he was cheered on. You know, they were all yelling, "Reagan, Reagan." This is the Neshoba County Fair. And they were all yelling, "We want Reagan." He comes back 4 years later. He says, "I believe in states' rights." He goes on and on. He talks about Chicago welfare queens, 80 with 80 names and 30 addresses and 12 social security cards who are collecting veterans benefits and four. These are all quotes, by the way, with four non-existing deceased husbands. She's got Medicaid, getting food stamps, and she is collecting welfare under each of her names. Her tax-free cash income is over $150,000. That would be a quote from Reagan. And of course, you mentioned plenty with the United Nations quotes. Yeah, it just goes on and on.
And can you touch on that Lenin story? Because just to bring it back to the John Birch Society and why, as you posture in your piece, it never left. Seems like Reagan got his foreign policy theories straight from their books as well.
Yes. Robert Welch met in Indianapolis, and he gave a 2-day speech with 11 other leaders of business. It was over a weekend. And he, one part of the speech, he offered a quote from, supposedly it's from Lenin. Lenin never said it. It was a made up quote. That communism would not be an invasion. The United States would simply fall under the charm of communism. And pretty soon we would become a communist nation. We would, a single shot would not be fired. Reagan repeated the exact same thing that Robert Welch said in the first meeting of the John Birch Society.
And it was made up. And it was made up.
And it was made up. And it was made up. He continued to say this on in many campaign stops along the way, because he was running for president for a long time throughout the late 1970s. He fails to win in 76, and he's running all through the Carter's years. Yeah. So.
Yeah, I think that's just a fascinating story because it just shows how, you know, information gets repeated, believed, even if it's not true. And of course, we saw the same dynamic with Donald Trump. Breitbart. Yeah. Put it up on Breitbart. put it up on what was it, Gateway Pundit, put it up on InfoWars, and then it's out of his mouth. OAN, the same dynamic, except, you know, now just because Trump was more belligerent and offensive to people's sensibilities, then it's being called out. But it just, it was not done so in the Reagan era, is what you're, you know, alluding to, I would say.
It was the same situation. His aides were going around saying, we've got to temper this guy. He is saying things that aren't true. These are unfounded. And this is the time when, you know, you really couldn't get away with this. You know, you would look foolish. But, you know, it's a little different now. And you still can look foolish, but it's there are fewer fact checkers, right? And Donald Trump was able to get away with it. Reagan was too, but he would go around saying, we've got to get rid of fiat money. We've got to get rid of, he would make these numbers up, like for every $3 that are sent to the federal government, the American people get $1 back. And it was just out of thin air.
It really is. I always remain so fascinated by just seeing mirror images throughout history. And I want to end on this last topic, and I'll let you go, just about the John Birch Society's role in kind of putting forward even abortion conspiracy theories that we're still seeing today. You write about how they would issue bumper stickers that said, support your local police and law and order. That was repeated through Nixon. That came from conservative think tanks and Reagan, and Stop the Steal was even in existence back then. I read up a good amount on Roger Stone and, you know, I don't know if he was directly involved with John Birch Society, but just like those kinds of conservatives and how they're still felt so acutely today. Can you talk about just those social issues like law and order, policing, abortion. How the John Birch Society still makes its impact known on our discourse?
Well, yeah, the law and order, that is their signal calling. Richard Nixon runs on a campaign for law and order. But even before that, in the early 1960s, the John Birch Society had the support your local police organization because they feared that the federal government was going to take over local police forces. And as far as the social issues, they really get moving and they drive the social issues in the 1970s. It's amazing. Robert Welch, I realized in my research that he was in trouble in terms of the membership, but he did this brilliant thing. He established these ad hoc committees. These ad hoc committees shifted the emphasis into organizing instead of recruiting full-fledged members. These ad hoc committees weren't necessarily constituted by people who were members of the John Birch Society, but they would support social issues like Motoried was the social issue, and they were against abortion. They came out against abortion in the late 1960s, and it's not until the mid or early 1960s that Richard Nixon realizes, after James Buckley wins the New York seat for Senate under the Constitution, under the Conservative Party in New York, that you can use abortion as a wedge issue, as a cultural issue to win elections. And Richard Nixon changes his position. And a lot of Protestants change their position on abortion and become anti-abortion. Like W.A. Criswell was pro-abortion. But there were so many Catholics in the John Birch Society, and Welch was so far ahead of the game. He was pushing, especially his right-hand man, Jack McManus, in the John Birch Society to be anti-abortion. So they drove that movement as well. So,
yes. And, we've and we could go on forever. I know we're bumping up against our time, but I just, the QAnon movement too is it's all about the children and protecting the children. Like, there's still so many of these threads, right? The children are being, you know, molested by these satanic, like all of these conspiracy theories do revolve around some of the same trope. So anyway, fascinating stuff. Ted Miller, professor at Northeastern University. Your upcoming book is called A Conspiratorial Life, Robert Welch, the John Birch Society, and the Revolution of American Conservatism. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Oh, thank you very much. I really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you very much.
That's it for another week of Ring of Fire Radio. Hey, are you still subscribed to the free show? Do us both a favor. Head over to rofpodcast.com. Support the show by becoming a member. Don't forget, you can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can watch our videos on YouTube. You can go to ringoffireradio.com to find out more. And check out my daily show, The Majority Report. Head over to majority.fm for my daily live stream at 12 noon Eastern every day or later as a podcast. Emma Vigeland and I cover all the biggest news stories of the day. We do in-depth interviews. Check it out. You'll like it. For Emma Vigeland and Heather Parton, I'm Sam Cedar. This has been Ring of Fire.